From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
When the umpteenth reader or listener to A Way to Garden emailed me this spring to say that I would really identify with the current bestseller, Lab Girl, by Hope Jahren, how could I resist? So thanks to those urgings, this week I escaped into the first official volume of my 2016 summer reading list, and you were correct, I felt right at home, even though Jahren and I come at our fascination with plants from very different directions. Hope Jahren is a geobiologist, a three-time Fulbright Award recipient, and a tenured professor at the University of Hawaii. Beyond her scientific distinctions, she is also a lover of leaves and of trees, in possession of a great gift for writing, and a wild and wonderfully alive sense of humor, something it turns out in the 20-ish years of adventures she takes us on in Lab Girl that it never hurts having with her to fall back on. Welcome to A Way to Garden, Hope Jahren, and thank you for this exhilarating book. It really is.
Oh, thank you so much. It gives me great joy to hear that you found something good in it.
Oh, many things good. and I'm not even sure, for people who haven't read it yet, I'm not even sure how to say what it's about without sounding kind of all woo-woo and, you know, by saying, like, it's about life, but it is about your life and about life on Earth as well. What's it about?
I'm like the woo-woo, I think, of all the different descriptions I've heard people offer. I think that hits about as close to the heart as you can get it. It's everything I am and like to think about, and like every woman, you know, that includes both my interests and what consumes me in my labor every day and what consumes me in my life at home and the friendships that created me and the goals that I've striven for and the goals that I redefined as I was striving for goals that I didn't know I was striving for. I think it's a book that I wrote to make sense of my life. I mean, I got to be, I've been a professor for 20 years, and that's about the time that a lot of professors write, you know, their big textbook that says, here's what I've learned and here's how we should teach the next generation differently in order to prepare them for the new problems that are yet to be solved. And when I sat down to do that, it turned out to be a very different book. I couldn't talk about what I'd learned.
Yes.
I couldn't talk about what I'd learned without talking about how we did it, without talking about the people that were so terribly important, and without talking about the ways that life intervened along the way, and it all got mixed together, and in the end, it went to the reader, and there's quite a few people saying, hey, you know, there's something good in there, and it's a real joy for me as an author.
Well, I know geology, I don't know it the way you know it, but I know what it is, and I know what biology is, but what is geobiology? I kind of fear that when I was in school, I knew what earth science was, but I don't know what geobiology is. What's geobiology?
Right. So one of the things we do in your universities is make up new words. And geobiology, I think, is a good one because it breaks down to exactly what you think it is. It's a combination of geology and biology, just like you said. It's the way in which those two spheres interact. So there's things outside your window that you can point to that aren't alive, the rocks and the stream and the clouds and the atmosphere, things you can point to that are alive, you know, the tree and a leaf and a worm and the roots in your garden, et cetera. And I'm interested in the processes that convert the one to the other. I'm interested in that magic moment when one becomes the other, when it succeeds, and when it fails, and why, and how that's changed over 400 million years, how the ground rules for that have changed over long periods of time. To me, that's the biggest question on the planet.
Yeah. So I had a big chuckle when you write in the book that the type of science you do is sometimes referred to as curiosity-driven research, because I kind of think that's the kind of gardening that I do as well. I'm always out there curious. But seriously, can you explain how this differs from the science that's being conducted in other labs?
Well, absolutely. It is all happening in your garden. And there's nobody more similar to me and what I do in my job than somebody who just loves to be in their garden for the sake of being there. And isn't it, even if your garden fails and you don't get one good piece of food out this year, if you can say, I'm still glad I did that and I'm going to do it next year, then you are a heck of a lot more like me than you think you are. What am I mean when I say non-curiosity-driven? I wouldn't say non-curiosity-driven. I'd say more applications-focused.
Right.
But I'm talking
right.
about science that's really got a blueprint on it as to how we can make that work yield a drug that will cure somebody, or a bridge that will take somebody somewhere, or a machine that will create something. So that kind of research. Whereas the kind I do answers questions that come to us through our curiosity, and those answers are the building blocks that we need to someday get to those applications.
I see.
But that piece would be somebody else in a different kind of lab doing a different kind of work that I do.
So in your lab, you have, let's say, gardens, and you, in the book, I think you describe them as sort of, they're tiny, and a sort of neonatal ICU for tiny plants. So you kind of look at plants, and I don't know, are they in like plexiglass or behind glass? I look out the window at my landscape, you look at these plants growing. So tell us about the lab and the garden in the lab, so to speak.
That's absolutely what it is. They are plexiglass boxes. Uh-huh. All the stuff in there is basically built from stuff at the hardware store and stuff from, you know, a lot of it comes from radio. We go to a lot of the same stores that gardeners go to. People who garden indoors are kind of a special kind of gardener.
Uh-huh.
We cross a lot of different paths, but in my lab, we have a collection of little plexiglass boxes in which we grow tiny baby plants from seed, and we can control everything about their world, how much moisture they get, when the moisture is delivered, how much light they get, the pattern of that light, how long their day is, the relative humidity, the temperature. We can expose them to wind. We can give them the best growing season in the world or the poorest growing season in the world, and then watch how they react. We can go in and harvest them and measure anything you'd want to know about them. And in that way, we test their limits.
Right.
Both with respect to resources that they like and a lack of resources that they wish they had. We can also create conditions that we think might have been at work millions of years ago. We can put together hypothetical Earths that we think might exist if we look at scenarios where a tremendous number of cars are adopted in China, countries like India and China, for example. Mm-hmm. So we can look at different versions of the future and grow these little model plants, and then we can start to spin out theories about how the future might affect the food supply or the wood supply or even the medicine supply, because an awful lot of plants are used as medicinal agents.
And you just said two parts at least of the, or maybe all of them, of this sort of triumvirate that you mention in the book, and I've heard you speak about in other interviews: food, medicine, wood. Because why? Why those three words?
Right. I like to remind people, I like to remind my students that so much of the basis of our lives goes back to the exploitation of plant tissues. Plants are food, medicine, and wood. And we don't see it anymore, but, you know, if you even look around the room that you're in and really open your eyes, it's amazing how much stuff is made of wood. It's still our primary building material. And, of course, food, and, of course, a lot of what keeps you well and healthy originally comes from plants. But that's not all they are. Plants don't exist in huge numbers for hundreds of millions of years in order to faithfully provide these three commodities to human beings, right? So they function according to a whole constellation of their own agenda. They are trying to live on planet Earth and reproduce and grow and weather, environmental change and weather times of need and illness and all these sorts of things. And so I dedicated my career to really trying to look at the world from that perspective,
right.
Given both the limitations and the opportunities available to plants. How do they solve the problem of not dying every day?
Well, you say in one section of the book, a cactus doesn't live in the desert because it likes the desert. It lives there because the desert hasn't killed it yet. Which,
yeah.
Boy, yeah. Is that the truth.
Yeah, and that's an old idea, in the natural sciences, is that, when you find something in the world, you find it because that's where it likes to live, and it likes it there, and everything's great. And the truth is actually more to the effect of, if you find it there, it's because the world hasn't entirely filtered it out. That's what can make a go of it there. So if you look at plants' lives as really a struggle, using a certain number of wild advantages, they can do an incredible number of things we can't, and also with limitations that come from being a plant and not an animal. Like, you can't move away from whatever's bothering you.
Right.
If you look at how to navigate the world successfully using that array of approaches, it's a really interesting, imaginative problem that has led to 20 years of fun thinking about it with no end in sight.
And one of your first discoveries, so we go back 20 or however many years, and there was this first moment when you had an aha, you made a discovery, and you were the only person in that instant who knew this fact. It was with a hackberry, yes?
Right, exactly.
Tell me about that.
So the hackberry is kind of a modest little tree. It's of modest stature. It's neither big nor small, and it makes little fruits. They look about like a cranberry, and they're structured like a peach. So there's a skin and then a fleshy outer part and then a hard pit. And inside that pit is a seed. And like the peach, that pit is made out of mineral. It's made out of rock. And a lot of living things make parts of themselves out of rock. Your teeth and bones are an example of that.
Yes.
And peach pits as well are made out of rock. And there's a whole host of other things inside plants you find that are made out of minerals. My very first job was to figure out, well, what kind of mineral is it? Because if we're going to do any kind of analysis on this, we've got to know what we're dealing with. And so I faithfully collected a bunch of these and put them in a machine called an X-ray diffraction machine to figure out what the mineral was. And I happened to get the result in the middle of the night, which happens when you're doing science. And I found myself in this unusual place. This was before cell phones and internet and everything else, but I found myself in this unusual situation where I had what to me felt like important information, and I didn't have anybody to tell. And I had to sit with that information until the sun came up, and I could call somebody because it was a reasonable hour and say, hey, guess what I did? And it occurred to me that for those hours while I was waiting for the dawn, I was the only person on Earth who knew that. It was a complete unknown before I did it, and then it was a known, And that's separate from whether that was important information or, all that kind of business. But it was proof that, by spending time with this plant, by doing something both with my hands and with my mind, I had gotten to this place where I could point to something tangible that illustrated how I was special, in a world of,
right.
of endless, variations on the human form. There was something about me that came from my work with this plant that yielded something that you just couldn't argue wasn't truly unique.
And it was opal, yes?
I remember enjoying that moment and getting addicted to that moment and wanting another one.
It was opal? Was that what it turned out to be? It was opal?
It was opal. It was the kind of experiment where the result is so obvious you know, there's some experiments that, you know, you move heaven and earth and you can't get it right. It's so temperamental and tweaky. And there are some experiments that you just can't mess up. And that was one of them. And, you know, when you get data like that, it somehow feels like you were meant to know this.
Right.
So there I was with my clear, clear result. And I sat there with myself and took those hours to enjoy it as mine. And that became a big moment in the book. And gosh, I haven't been able, in 20 years of doing science and talking to other scientists and getting awards, you know, I haven't ever been able to tell anybody about that terribly, terribly important moment. And that's why the book was such a joy to write and to offer to readers.
Well, and we got to meet Bill, who's your unforgettable and beloved colleague, Bill, who we all now love as you do. By extension, we now love him and appreciate all his efforts over these years. Now, I know from the book, toward the end of the book, I know that he has an actual garden, and I believe he has sort of prize mango trees. I think it's mangoes. But do you garden as well outside the lab, outside the plexiglass?
I don't.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's
more
okay.
I'm more like my mother when it comes to plants. She wanted, and we did garden together. That was one of my early.
I remember that, yeah.
But she liked plants that could do for themselves. She wasn't going to nurse along any little delicate thing. She wanted something that you put it in the ground, you came back later and ate it. And I feel that way about houseplants. I said, I've had enough temperamental little plants mess with my career,
right,
and give me sleepless nights, that I'm not going to welcome one into my home and put it on the windowsill.
I think you said, yeah, your mother appreciated plants like rhubarb and chard.
you had to practically beat it back as opposed to cultivate it. And even peonies and plants that came from bulbs, you know, irises and tiger lilies and things like that. She liked those. She felt like those were dependable. And they wanted to be in the world, you know. If you want to be here, grow strong and grow hard and poke your head up out of the soil, because it gets started sooner rather than later. That's how she looked at it.
Later in the book, another character we meet when he's born, and there was a little bit of a moment like that first aha and that secret that only you knew when you met him. Your son was born. And I guess I wanted to ask, what did you want when he got old enough to know something about plants and about your work? What did you want him to know first? What was the most exciting thing to tell him, to teach him?
Oh, gosh. Of all the questions I get asked, that is a tough one. I will put that one right up there with some of the tough.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I know that he, there's an anecdote that he likes to make a sound banging on a particular tree in the backyard.
Yes, but, and that's something I talk about, is that everybody has a tree from their childhood.
Yes.
I mean, I think some people are still waiting to meet their tree, but it's very common that I meet people that when I wrote about, you know, I had this tree that I didn't realize I was so attached to until my parents had to cut it down. And it felt like a bigger loss than I'd ever even considered. People will come to me and say, yeah, I had a tree in my backyard like that too. And I don't know, we're drawn to these things, especially as kids, when we need something bigger than we are and stable and we can take it for granted, and et cetera. My son has one that he practices his baseball swing on. And
it's some type of a palm.
It's a palm tree. It flexes, and it's not hurting it. It's just as green at the top as the other trees. But he was really, I asked him one day, you know, I have this idea that everybody has a favorite tree. Which one is yours? And he automatically said, that one.
Right.
With all the baseball bat marks on the bottom that go up, you know, because he gets taller, so that whacking part has gotten higher over the years.
I lost a tree recently in a manner that was unexplained and startling to me. And at least until I started reading a little bit, and I asked a few more expert friends, and I started digging around in the root zone and saw a kind of white, I don't know if it's mycelium or what you call the sort of hairy anyway, fungal, something
yeah.
fungal.
And fungal.
Yeah, and yeah. there was, so I started doing some research, but never mind, I'm not a pathologist, and I'll find out the answer when I get the samples back and so forth. But there's a wonderful section in the book about this partnership between, a sort of for better or for worse, partnership between trees and fungus. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Right. So you know that the roots are important because they are what allow the tree to interface with the wet world and also all the things that come in dissolved into that water, nitrogen and
right.
magnesium and all the great things that fertilize growth. So more roots is better. Right? You can never have too much absorptive power.
Mm-hmm.
And what the fungi basically do is they entwine in there and they act to increase that surface area. They wrap around the roots and they act like roots and they draw the stuff in and they kind of share what comes out. And as a reward, the plant offers a little bit of sugar. So the fungus brings stuff in and it pulls stuff out, and both of them have an easier time than they would if they were solo. It's not what we call an obligate symbiosis, in that both of those plants and the fungus could live, you know, quite well on their own, but for better or for worse, they choose to live in that association. And it's an odd sort of metaphor for friendship.
Yes.
We could function without key people in our lives, but gosh, we'd just rather not.
Yeah. No.
And sometimes that is enough to explain somebody who's been in your life for decades.
In the last few minutes, dare I ask you how you feel about leaves? Because I think you're as passionate about them as I am. And I actually have a garden that's mostly made up of things that have exceptional foliage, not flowers. I'm not much of a flower gardener. And whether indoors or outdoors, I really collect plants and get attracted to plants because of their foliage. I think you, from a young age, also have loved leaves, yes?
Yes. You know, leaves work. They do the work of the plant. They offer themselves to the sky, and when the lights are on, they are working. Any tissue that has green in it also has chlorophyll in it, which means it is working. You know, flowers are pretty and they lead to reproduction and they provide kind of a stage for some important bits. But the leaves are the beating heart of the plant, so to speak. It's a bad metaphor taken literally, but it's a decent metaphor if you think about it in a very, very sort of symbolic way. It's the part that feeds it's the part that at the end of the day needs to work in order to start the whole show.
Yes. Well, I, as much as I know about plants from a practical sense, I have to say that after reading Lab Girl, your best-selling book, congratulations again, that I have a new appreciation for many, many aspects of them. And I'm glad that all the metaphors are there in the book. Yeah, it's very, very rich. And thank you so much for making the time to join me, Hope Jaron from Hawaii.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay. And thanks to all of you for joining me as well. Now, don't miss an episode. You can tune in anytime to the podcast version. Download it on Stitcher or iTunes. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or facebook.com/awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.